This morning I'm speaking with Miguel Siuco, who was actually born in the Philippines and is back here in Adelaide now for the 2012 Adelaide Writers' Week. Welcome back to Adelaide, Miguel.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be home.
Yes, well, home. I was going to ask you about that concept of home a little bit later, but you do have a sort of an attraction to Adelaide, as you'd lived in Adelaide and would call it home, would
yes.
you?
Yes. After I graduated from my master's degree in New York, which was the first time really living abroad as an adult, I fell in love with an Australian girl,
yes.
Edith, who's from Townsville in far north Queensland, and she had an opportunity to study. She was the first in her family to go to university, so it was a big deal, and she got into the University of Adelaide. So we moved from Manhattan to Adelaide for her to study, and it was a great adventure. This was in 2005, February 2005. It was my first, time completely independent in a country I knew nobody, no friends, no friends of friends. Mm. And we settled down here, and I did a series of odd jobs. I worked as I stocked shelves, I think, in Bunnings first. That was my first thing, early in the morning. My second job was I was working for this fellow named Robert Simmons, who was a bookie. We went all around the horse races to the tracks in South Australia, and I was his assistant.
Yes.
That was a fascinating introduction to Australian culture. Mm. And then finally I got a job working for the Independent Weekly, a wonderful group of people, the best people I've ever worked with, I think. Old journalists from everywhere, many of them from News Limited. And they wanted to put up a paper that would stop Adelaide from being a one newspaper town, because that's not healthy.
No.
There was this feeling of having fought the good fight, and I loved working with them. I was a sub-editor, and then I was a staff writer, and then I was handling I was the editor for their online in daily.
Mm-hmm.
2.5 years went by very quickly.
So as if you were to come back to Adelaide sort of fated as a draw card to the Adelaide Writers' Week. It must be a big change.
Oh, well, it blows my mind. It seems like just yesterday I was thrilled to be part of the Writers' Week, because the Independent Weekly had invited Robert Fisk.
Mm.
And I very nervously went up there because I was appointed to introduce him. And, a few years later, suddenly... Here I am.
You're one of the guests.
I'm one of the guests.
Now, I should backtrack a little bit, probably, and just tell our listeners that you were actually born in the Philippines.
Yes.
And, but you now live in Toronto, is that right?
No, I live in Montreal.
Sorry, in Montreal. And your book, Illustrado, won the Man Asia Award in what year was that?
2008. It was still a manuscript.
And that's what I want to talk about sort of particularly today. And talk about things Filipino, because I've got that sort of interest in the Philippines too.
I think
that's why I specifically wanted to talk to you. Now, but first, probably just something about Illustrado. It's a very complex story, very many separate voices and separate styles. I was sort of wondering what the motivation was behind the novel and its development, how it all came together, how you managed to bring all those different strands of voices and styles together into one book.
Well, it was a long process of trying to figure out the story that I wanted to tell, and then figure out how to tell it. I was doing it as part of a PhD at the University of Adelaide. I worked with some wonderful people, Nicholas Joes, Di Schwert, and Brian Castro. They encouraged me to try something different, and I wanted to write a book that was faithful to the Philippine literary tradition in English.
Mm.
Because Filipinos, as a former colony of America, we've been writing in English for 100 years, and we have a very strong tradition. But a lot of it, there's magic. It has sort of elements of magical realism or social commentary and all of those things. And at times it can seem very exotic or very didactic. And so I wanted to write a book that acknowledged that I come from that tradition, but tried to improve on that, tried to be at the edge of that evolution somehow. Mm. And because I had the encouragement at the University of Adelaide to try all these things, and to fail and try again and fail better. I was able to do that. So what I did was, first I wrote 200,000 words. It was a huge monolithic manuscript that even I didn't want to read. It was just a straight narrative. And one day I was watching a documentary. I was in despair. I didn't know what to do with about my book. And I saw how these women in the southern Philippines, in this Daco, they were weavers. And they were weaving this textile that we're all very familiar with in the Philippines. And, you know, it seems very obvious to me now, but when I saw their process of how they spun the threads individually, dyed each one a certain color, positioned them in a pattern in the loom, and then wove them together, I thought, well, that's how I need to write my book. So I took my 200,000 word manuscript apart, opened up 10 different Microsoft Word documents, and I teased out each narrative thread and developed it on its own. Steeped it and dyed it in its own color and texture, and then wove them together to try to create a story that, you know, proceeds according to patterns and themes, and approximates what I think is contemporary life. I mean, how do we get our news in this day and age? We get it through radio, we get it through television, internet, gossip, a word of mouth, the ticker along the news programs on TV. We're multitaskers now, we human beings. And I thought, well, I wanted to write a book that is as fragmented and as multi-sourced as real life is. In fact, if you ask me, the traditional novel form that we see being churned out by so many writers and publishers these days is so, to me, it's archaic. And people talk about the novel being dead. Well, yeah, it's going to be dead if you just continue to not let it reflect real life in the way we read and live today. So that's what I wanted to do with the book. But a lot of failures and a lot of false starts led me on the path.
So you'd probably be one of the few people who successfully turned a PhD thesis into a readable novel. You know, I mean, is it possible? And obviously it is possible.
Well, yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think the University of Adelaide, I can't speak to the other programs, but the University of Adelaide has a great track record of PhD candidates coming out with good books.
Yes,
Patrick Allington, for example, who's from Adelaide, came out with a wonderful book, which was his PhD. And, well,
it can be done.
It can be done.
Yes,
and
I
mean, in a way, it seems even more likely that it could be done because you have the whole support of your supervisors and readers and friends.
Peers, yeah.
Yeah.
I just jump forward to something that you said about the Filipino style, I suppose. Can you actually talk about an authentic contemporary Filipino style of writing? There's different traditions, of course, Spanish tradition, you know, American tradition, perhaps even a Marxist influence in there. Is that what you're trying to do? You're trying to sort of create something very new and very different?
I am. I want to take from those traditions.
We can see evidence of them in Illustrados.
Oh, I'm glad.
Certainly.
I'm glad to see that. But it wasn't really. It was a conscious effort, but I don't think it was too much of an effortful effort. I am Filipino. I grew up in the Philippines, and this is the stuff I grew up reading. So I thought, well, why react to it in such a violent way? Why reject it? Let's accept that and see if we can move on. And through the book, that's what I tried to do. We do have all of those influences. And that's a wonderful thing. I've got a friend, Tishani Doshi, who's an Indian writer. And she says, oh, you know, everyone thinks that Indians are exotic and they're like this and they're like that. And it's true, we are, but you can either wallow in it or reject it, neither of which is authentic. Or you can take it for what it is and move forward with it. And I think, especially with Filipino writing, authenticity is a really big, it's a thorny issue. Authenticity, sometimes it's a catchword that is used by the entrenched who are territorial and want to exclude you from the conversation. And in the 1960s and 70s, because, you know, we got our independence from the United States in 1946, in the subsequent decades, there was this urge to reclaim what we were to find this newfound nationalism. And it went from the extreme of colonialism to the extreme of post-colonialism, where they tried to find an authentic that predated, you know, 50 years of American history and 400 years almost of Spanish occupation. And that to me is inauthentic. So this idea of inauthenticity, of authenticity, is really a thorny issue. And one of the things I'm trying to put forward in my book, and I think this is something that is pertinent to not just Filipino writing, but writing from any other post-colonial country, even Australia, for example. I wanted to get beyond the tropes and the cliches. And I wanted to accept the fact that we are all those things. What is Philippine culture? It's traditional Filipino. There's Malay, Chinese, American, Spanish. There's a little bit of Indian. There's Muslim, Catholic, liberal, conservative. I mean, there's so many influences. And yet the Filipinos, as we create our own myth of ourselves and form our own sense of our national consciousness, we're still coming to terms with that multiplicity. To me, that's what authentic Filipino is. But you won't hear many Filipinos saying that, at least not yet.
So you're talking about authenticity, and certainly in the novel, you know, it seems to create a sense of historical reality, but in the end it's really a total fabrication, isn't it? And does that really matter? Is that part of the myth that you're sort of building on?
Well, yeah, I mean, I write fiction. I wouldn't even say it's historical fiction. I do take from history, and I try to take these ossified, sometimes even forgotten or overly lionized heroes and figures and events from Philippine history, and I try to breathe life into them again through fiction. But it's a book about contemporary Philippines. And I guess I wouldn't say it's historical. I wouldn't say it's a fabrication. In my book, I have real figures and I have fictional figures. I have real newspapers that are cited and publications, and I have fictional publications and newspapers. And I want the reader, in fact, my main character, one of them is named Miguel Sihuko. And he's not me, he's sort of loosely based on me. But what I wanted the reader to take away from this is, as they go through Ilustrada, they're constantly wondering what is real, what is not. And I hope that at the end of the book, when everything comes together, because I'd like to think, I know it's a tough book, it's that's what I've been told, but in the end it does come together. At the end, I hope the reader will say, well, is it real? Is it not? Is it fact? Is it fiction? It doesn't really matter, because it's true. It rings true. And I think that's the power of fiction, is that it causes a discussion amongst communities and even within ourselves of what is real, what is not, what matters, what doesn't. And it makes us think for ourselves rather than, when you pick up a history book, you just kind of absorb things and take it as gospel.
So I wonder about that sort of effect that a writer has. And one of your characters says that a writer writing about sex won't get anybody pregnant, which I guess is something about the influence that writers really have. And I think there's also another statement in Ilustrado saying, how can anyone estimate the ballistic qualities of words? So there must be some thoughts there about the effect that you as a writer, or that writers in general, you think might have, or a hope that perhaps might wield some sort of influence on events or history?
Yeah, I think most writers, when they set down to write something, I mean serious writers, not those who are just trying to make money because it's a living, but who want to change literature, who want to change the way people see or understand the world. I think when they sit down to write, there is this hope that they can contribute somehow. But then in the back of their heads, there's always that niggling worry where they say, well, what am I doing spending, as I did, 4 years writing this book that maybe nobody will read? When I could be out there, you know, entering politics, being an activist, a grassroots organizer, building houses for Habitat for Humanity, you know, working with the poor. There are all these questions that I think a lot of writers have. But I think that, and maybe this is just the way I've rationalized it in my own head, going to build a house for someone poor or entering politics, sure, that's all very hands-on and immediate. But I think literature is the long game. The effects aren't immediate. I have no illusions that people are going to, especially in the Philippines, are going to pick up my book and decide to overthrow the government and create a communist utopia or whatnot. But I do hope that, you know, my book is now being taught in universities, and that these young students will read it and think differently or understand things a little bit differently or more clearly. And that will affect how they live or what they want to do. And maybe these students one day will enter politics themselves and remember the lessons that I'm trying to share with them or discuss with them, or become the CEOs of companies or student leaders or community activists, that sort of thing. That's what I think, that's what I hope. I don't think I'm going to make a difference in 5-10 years, but hopefully in 50 years I might. And to a country like the Philippines that is still forming itself, finding this is one brick in the foundation of the story we're telling about ourselves for our current generation and the future generations. Australia has a great way. Australia, America, France, there are so many countries that do this very well. They have a great sense of self. They're very well represented, and they have all of these mirrors to gaze upon themselves through the arts and television and sport and even just their sense of patriotism. But the Philippines, because we have a fragmented past, we're still forming that. So I'm hoping that I can contribute that way somehow in my small little way.
I wanted to pick up too, particularly on one of what I think is a very strong theme in your writing, in Illustrato, but also that sort of idea of home. I did hear, you read a short story, I think, in a series on Where is Home? I think it was something to do with the Edinburgh Festival.
Yes, that's right.
And I was interested in the character, you know, who was about to marry, he was thinking about home and belonging. There's a lot of sadness, and despite sort of connection to the social media, particularly there, a lack of connection and a lack of intimacy. So that's sort of it seemed there in that story that you were exploring that idea of home. So I wondered, what's your idea of home? I mean, are you an expatriate Filipino writer, or are you just a writer?
I am just a writer. A writer from Argentina named Rodrigo Fresan, who I was doing a festival with recently, or about a couple of years ago. He said this thing that really just opened my eyes. He says, I was born an Argentine, but I want to die a writer. And I love that.
Yes.
And
yeah.
I'm Filipino, I'm nothing else. But, you know, I've lived all over the world. And I consider myself a writer. And the wonderful thing about being a writer is that you can be a vagabond. And you can, writers, journalists, you put yourself in other people's shoes and you see the world. And that's why I've chosen this path. So Adelaide is home. Vancouver is home because I spent some years there as a child, growing up during the Marcos dictatorship with my parents. New York is home. I spent 4 years there. Montreal is home. I've spent the last 5 years of my life there. I spent just under a year in Paris. I used to visit my brother in summers in London, and my relatives in Spain and Barcelona. All those places are home to me.
So it's not a sense of dislocation with all those places it would seem to me that, you know, a place or one or two perhaps you could get away with calling home, but it seems like there'd be a sense of dislocation involved in trying to attach yourself to all those places.
I think it's more like you're building a bigger house. You're putting extensions in the house that you have.
Very big extensions.
Yes. You know, you've decided to put in another wing.
Yes.
And, you know, on one hand, you might feel a sense of dislocation or that your experience with a certain place is only cursory. But I don't think so. You can't live in a place for a year or 2 years or 5 years without really feeling part of it.
Mm.
I mean, there are... That whole question is a little bit muddied as well because I am Asian.
Mm.
And I have lived in places where I didn't feel comfortable so much as an Asian. And so I seek out cities where that's not even an issue.
Mm.
I have to admit, here in Australia, I didn't feel all that comfortable being an Asian, mm. not in all situations. And now living in Montreal, it's not an issue at all. I don't feel that at all.
Mm.
And to me, that's the mark of a mature society.
Mm. That's right. It's something to do with the maturity of the place you're living in, isn't it?
Yeah.
Rather than anything to do with yourself.
You're right. And I'm not saying that Australia is immature. I'm just saying that it's still a young country.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's still learning.
And that's a good thing in many things. But, you know, I mean, the racism that Asians or Africans or Aboriginals might feel, or Indians might feel here in Australia. And, I mean, we have to face it. It's there.
Mm.
I would imagine in a generation, 5-10 years even, that won't even be an issue. And that's part of the immigrant experience, and that's also part of a young country learning about itself. And I think that's a wonderful thing.
Mm.
But for myself, because I can choose to live anywhere I want as a writer, I do seek out places where I feel home, where I feel that the color of my skin and my accent, or even my background, makes no difference. That's one of the reasons I left the Philippines.
Mm.
Sorry,
I wanted to ask you about that because your character Crispin says at one stage, I think, it took more guts to be an international writer than to stay at home. So you could have stayed, but you didn't. Yeah. Could I ask why?
Yeah, sure. Several reasons. My father's a politician in the Philippines. So my last name is... It comes with certain connotations of some privilege, some wealth. And I don't think that's a very healthy thing for anyone to have. And I wanted to get beyond that. I wanted to really be independent and be my own man. And so I left. So there was that personal aspect, that family aspect. But there was also the sense that as a writer coming from a bourgeois privileged background in the Philippines, I would never be accepted. Again, because of that nationalism that we had, it's almost this pseudo-Marxism that we still hold on to when it comes to literature in the Philippines. And I knew that I could never make it there. I would always be rejected as this. Yeah.
Wouldn't it have given you more opportunities to be part of that?
No.
Class?
Whatever opportunities I made on my own would always be explained away as opportunities because of my last name or whatever. And I like being in a place where I'm just a regular guy.
So you've really been reinventing your own identity, too.
I have been.
Yeah.
I have been. I had a childhood nickname that my family called me, and in the Philippines I grew up with, it was Chuck, because I looked like Charlie Brown when I was a little boy. And when I left the Philippines in 2001, I said, well, you know what, I want to shrug off all of that and start anew.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took my real name, which my given name, which is Miguel. I never used it before. So anyone who's met me after 2001 knows me as Miguel. And it really is an interesting dichotomy. I'm two people in a way. But I did really want to reinvent myself. I did want to find a place where I started from scratch. And that's what Adelaide was for me.
Yes, yes.
I came here with nothing, with credit card debt from having gone to Masters. We just scraped and ate instant noodles and the cheapest thing you can buy at Subway every day, every meal, for a very long time. And, you know, this is where I bought my first car. It's $2,000, an old 70s rust bucket, which I loved, my first house, my first job. So as far as roots go, this is a very important one, Adelaide.
Mm-hmm. So it's probably refreshing to sort of have that, to walk outside that sort of position that you had in the Philippines and to be who you were without the extra sort of addition of name and, you know, class and everything on top of that.
Exactly. And the whole egalitarianism here in Australia, where they take you for who you are, you know, I found that extremely refreshing, as opposed to the very stratified, class-conscious society that the Philippines is. But that's also what Ilustrado is about. So Crispin Salvador, you know, he was an old writer who had made his way living as an expatriate. And I think any immigrant will tell you, any expatriate, whether they're a writer or not, living abroad, they'll always have this angst of, shouldn't I go home and help? Especially if you come from a country that's having a hard time. Am I a traitor to myself, to my people, to my background by living abroad? But truth be told, you know, it does on the face of it seem like that. I left the Philippines, you know, part of the brain drain, but I had to struggle abroad. I had, you know, I didn't know where my next meal or my next rents were coming from. I had nothing to fall back on. Couldn't go running home to mommy or daddy because, well, in my case, they had cut me off because they were displeased completely, you know, and I thought they'd die and I'd die without ever seeing each other again. That's what I was convinced would happen. And
so there was a matter of rejection, and but according to, because of your decision.
Yes. And that was the best thing that ever happened to me.
It's sort of a growing up thing too.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, living away from home, it's difficult. Friends, family, I had a girlfriend who I thought I was going to marry in the Philippines. I left her to study. I thought we'd get back together one day, and we didn't. You know, it was really tough, but a great adventure. And it made me the man who I am now, and I'm kind of coming to terms with that. You know, I'm pretty happy.
It's nice to see that Adelaide has been part of that story too.
A huge part of it.
Yes.
I came back last year. I was part of the Melbourne and Brisbane Writers Festival, and I came by to visit some mates, and I rented a car. You know, working at the Independent Weekly, I was there for all the openings. So that airport, that lovely airport that you have, I was there at the opening, the grand opening. IKEA over there, I was at the grand opening. So driving past over to my friend's house, seeing all these things, I was very emotional. I didn't expect to be. I thought it was just, yeah, it'd be fun. But I was a mess actually in that rental car, in tears. Just Adelaide, it all came rushing back.
Yes. I think probably finally our listeners would be very interested to hear the direction that your writing's going in now. Is it a similar sort of direction, or are you moving in a completely different direction with your current writing?
It's completely different in the form. I would like my career to be similar to that of, say, Stanley Kubrick's, rather than, say, Philip Roth. Well, Philip Roth just, you know, he looked at the one thing, the Jewish-American experience, and the different facets of it from all different angles. Where Stanley Kubrick tried, you know, horror, sci-fi, you know, period pieces, all of these different things. And I'd like to be able to try to do that. That's what I'd like to do. I'd like to be a Kubrick. So the next book is different in form. It's titled "I Was the President's Mistress."
It's certainly an engaging title, anyway.
it's a scandalous tell-all memoir of a young woman born in poor circumstances in the Philippines. A beautiful girl who sleeps her way to the top of society. In fact, it's not even about the Philippines. It's about this fabulistic third world society, which I hope will resonate not just with Filipinos, but anyone, you know, Malaysians, Indians, and Latin Americans. And through her story, we're able to look at different facets of a society. Because she goes, you know, she has relationships with different archetypes until finally she's the mistress of the president. And so this celebrity tell-all memoir, on the face of it, again, it's sexy, a little provocative, but I hope that at the end of the book people will have an understanding of how the different facets of power work in a third world country, and corruption as well, why corruption is there, the rationalizations and justifications that we make for it. Take it down from this abstract thing that we read about in reports and in the newspaper, and show how individuals, characters in my book, deal with this thing on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. So in one sense, yeah, I believe that writing can and should be a political act.
Mm.
I'll always choose different forms, but I think it will always be engaged in an examination of how the individual relates to the pressures of society and either tries to change those or influence them in their own way, or is in the end forced to succumb. And mm. I think that's the human story, that's the human condition. Mm. And you know, I don't ever want to write stories that just exist in tiny little vacuums. I'm interested in seeing human beings out in the world trying to make their way.
Well, I, for one, Miguel, I'm looking forward already to reading that book, and I'd like to thank you very much today for speaking to us.
Oh, it's my great pleasure, John. Thank you.
Thank you.